The World in Words is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/theworld.
Hi, I'm here today with a pod about words. Well, yeah, duh. But no, I'm talking about certain specific types of words, as in words deemed to be too rude to use in a text message. Also, a word of the year, something that has captured the zeitgeist. As it turns out, it's actually two words, but let's not split hairs. And some real and invented words that evoke snow.
Sorbet deluge.
So today, we have a report out of Fargo, North Dakota, about, well, it's something of an experiment in getting refugees to learn English, but getting them to do that without providing them with an English teacher. Also, the Oxford English Dictionary's Word of the Year, and some of the runners-up, and Kate Bush's 50 Real and Imagined Words for Snow. First, though, we go to Pakistan and the government's attempt to ban certain words, quite a lot of them, in text messages. The idea is simple. It's to protect ordinary Pakistanis from unsolicited and very rude text messages. So the government compiled a list of banned words and then told telecom companies it would be ordering them to filter all messages that contain those words. But ordinary Pakistanis don't think much of the plan. We have a report out of Karachi from Farhad Deshmukh, and I have to say there's a little epilogue to this at the end of his report.
The list is so bizarre as to be laughable.
Flogging the dolphin, axing the weasel, athlete's foot, backdoor man.
And those are just the words we're allowed to say on air. There are 1,600 English and Urdu words that the Pakistan Telecommunication Authority, or PTA, wants banned from text messages. According to a PTA directive leaked onto the internet, the aim is to clamp down on bulk messages that are, quote, harmful, fraudulent, illegal, or unsolicited. But the list has been criticized for its contents. It is, for the most part, a very comprehensive compilation of curse words, some actually very foul, others bizarre and beyond obscure. The list of Urdu words is crazier than the English one. One of the banned Urdu phrases roughly translates to the sweat of a lizard's pubic hair. No, there's nothing lost in translation here. The phrases sound just as ridiculous in Urdu as they do in English. It's hard to imagine why and how such phrases would ever be used. The English list also bans the use of the word Wu-Tang, as in the clan.
Wu-Tang!
Look at it from a child's point of view, then I think that maybe there needs to be some moderation of what we're exposing our children to. But overall, I think I would lean towards no.
I don't think we need to be mothered, really. I mean, what else is freedom of expression all about? I mean, I think it's really discomforting.
Who uses these in text, especially when you go over the Urdu word?
We just cannot understand where this madness will stop.
Shehzad Ahmed heads Bites for All, a human rights group that focuses on digital privacy and freedom of expression issues. The group is planning on taking legal action against the move. He worries that Pakistani officials may have an ulterior motive.
Since 2006, when Pakistan first started blocking cyberspace, it used to be in the name of blasphemous content, national security, fighting war on terror. But, I mean, we always found a political reason underneath all these different bans and censorship.
Texters are already discussing how to get around the ban. For The World, I'm Fahad Deshmukh in Karachi, Pakistan.
And this just in, as they say, breaking news, I'm hearing a voice in my ear. Well, I'm making that bit up. But anyway, Pakistani texters may not have to get around the ban. It looks like authorities are backing down. They're going to shelve the plan, at least for the time being. So, next time you're in Pakistan, maybe you'll still be free to send and receive texts that include the words monkey crotch. More words later, Kate Bush on her 50 Words for Snow and the Oxford English Dictionary defending its choice for Word of the Year. Before that, learning English in North Dakota. Yep, North Dakota takes in a lot of refugees for resettlement. Most of them wind up in the city of Fargo. And their children, no surprise here, they tend to outpace the adults in getting acclimated. So now some of the adults are getting English lessons of a sort. Here's our report out of Fargo from The Big Show's Jason Margolis.
Fargo police officer Christy Jacobson has responded to a lot of 911 calls, but few with less urgency than this one.
A teenage girl called the police on her mother because her mother had prepared a very simple ethnic meal for her, and she didn't like it.
Refugee children have been calling the Fargo police because they don't want to do the dishes or wear a particular shirt. Police have gotten a lot of calls about this. Parents were taking away their kids' Mountain Dew.
The children didn't like it because they had gotten used to drinking it. They enjoyed the caffeine splurge and things like that, and so it became a power struggle.
A few years back, the Fargo police assigned Jacobson to work as a cultural liaison officer with new refugees. Close to 4,000 have moved to the Fargo area since 1997. That's about 2% of the greater population. The refugees have come from places like Bosnia, Liberia, Iraq, and most recently a large influx from Bhutan. There's a common theme among the new arrivals.
The kids get to know the language and the culture before the parents do, and the parents are terrified.
That's Vonnie Sanders. She runs the English Language Learners Program for the Fargo School District. She says when refugee children arrive here, they're quickly placed in school. Their parents go to work cleaning hotel rooms or working in chicken processing plants. They don't get the benefit of immersion. The parents get some English instruction, but Sanders says it's not adequate.
It's 2.5-3 hours in the morning. That isn't enough for them, 4 days a week. The other thing is then when it comes to the end of the month, it's $2.50 to ride the bus. They can't afford to get there. Or they have a sick kid. They can't go.
In Fargo, there's another barrier to English learning, the winters. Police officer Christy Jacobson describes it this way.
Fargo, we actually won some national competition of being the worst weather city in the U.S. Yay, us.
Winter temperatures regularly dip down to negative 10 or negative 20 degrees.
And then with our wind chill factor, we can get into negative 30 or negative 40.
Now imagine you're a refugee from Rwanda or Sudan, and you don't have a car because you came to this country with nothing, and there's no direct bus to class.
And so you'll see them just bundled up like little Eskimos walking a couple miles to English class and back to their homes.
The refugees' lack of English skills has also caused some tension in the community. Heather Rank teaches a college class where she has her students write a letter to the editor about an international issue of concern.
And time after time in every class, I would see a fairly negative article from the students about why there were so many immigrants moving into the community. A lack of understanding about who refugees were or why they were here.
This got Rank thinking. There has to be a better way. She helped raise money through the local Rotary Club to provide alternative places and times for refugees to learn English.
The girl is drinking.
The girl is drinking.
What does that one say?
In this classroom, about a dozen refugees from Bhutan and Ethiopia are hunched over computers, looking at colorful images on the screens. They're using software from the company Rosetta Stone. A voice describes the photo. Then the students repeat a syllable, a word, or a phrase into a microphone. The students are paired off with volunteer tutors from the Rotary Club.
Drain.
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 This woman is trying to say the last syllable of the word children.
Drain.
That boy is.
Several volunteers get a little frustrated.
You're going to have to speak louder. Don't worry about us. Just you have to yell it.
I spoke with several refugees about their experience learning English. I wasn't able to go too in-depth with my questions because, not surprisingly, they don't speak much English. Still, I asked Beta Adikari from Bhutan what was better, the classroom or the computer.
Easier in a computer.
Why?
Because we listen the sound and accent. That is why it is easier to understand.
There haven't been any studies that show how well the software works with refugees, but local Rotarian Heather Rank provides this unscientific assessment.
I think it is working.
When Rank says it's working, she's talking about more than just the software. She says it's working because local volunteers are interacting with the new immigrants, and they're creating connections between communities. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis, Fargo, North Dakota.
It's going to take a while to figure out whether this kind of teacherless approach works for adults. It does sound as though these learners have a bit of a leg up with the volunteers helping them out, but it's still primarily Rosetta Stone discs. And is that really enough? Well, Jason didn't include it in his report, but he put the question to Jiaohan Hong. She's a professor of language and education at Columbia University. Here's what she said about the Rosetta Stone approach.
It's probably more effective for children than for adults. Adult learners generally find it harder to learn another language, and therefore they require, depend more on face-to-face instruction.
It might help, too, to have that face-to-face instruction for all of those other cultural bits and pieces around the language to help you learn it and help you get used to the new culture. Okay, a word of the year after this.
The World in Words is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook to consider is The Poisoner's Handbook, Murder and the Birth of Forensic Medicine in Jazz Age New York, by Deborah Blum. It's available at audiblepodcast.com/theworld.
As I'm sure you know, dictionaries and various interested language groups, they all come up with their own word of the year. Actually, it's often more than one word, as it is this year for the choice of the various editors, Americans as well as British, of the Oxford English Dictionary. It's interesting. In the past, the OED has chosen two words, one American, one British. But this year, they've gone for, as they put it, a global word. Coming up is a discussion of this term, but first, an illustration of its use and an attempt at a definition. And just by way of background, because to me, and maybe to you, it may not seem an especially new word or couple of words. It's new or newish in the UK, but it's been around for more than a decade in the US. Here's the illustration. This is British Labour Party leader Ed Miliband talking with the BBC's John Humphreys.
I think fundamentally this is a government out of touch with the needs of the middle classes and indeed the squeezed middle.
The squeezed middle is what? I don't know. I've no idea what you mean by the squeezed middle.
Well, you just define them, actually. Or I define them as people around the average income, both below and above the average income, not people on six-figure salaries.
That isn't a definition. That's just saying everybody is either above or below, by definition. We're all above or below something.
No, but look, I'm not talking about people on benefits. They're clearly not in the middle. And I'm not talking about people on six-figure salaries either. But I'm talking about the broad middle class in this country who find themselves financially hard-pressed.
The squeezed middle. Well, the BBC's James Naughtie talked about this choice with Oliver Cam, who writes a column called Pedant for the Times of London, and Susie Dent, who's with the Oxford English Dictionary.
Susie Dent, why the squeezed middle?
Well, it was a term that has acquired great resonance this year. Ed Miliband, as you heard, has taken quite a lot of stick for the vagueness of the term, but I think in a way...
And having heard that, you can understand why.
I think therein lies its power, if you like. It's one of those labels that, unlike chav, for example, which is another, you know, very prominent word from this century, it's not something that's been directed against people. It's something that, in a way, we all feel we belong to and we're opting into, and it's quite interesting from that point of view.
But do you think it's really... got traction, the squeezed middle? Well, isn't it just one of those little flimsy political phrases that has a moment in the sun and then fades away?
Well, you say so, but actually it has been around for some time. In fact, Bill Clinton quite liked the idea of the squeezed middle. He talked about hard-pressed working families squeezed in the middle, which sounds very familiar. So it has some history.
OK, Oliver Cam, what do you make of it?
Well, new words and phrases are being coined continually. Those that fill a perceived need become widely used. They are neologisms. Shakespeare brilliantly did this, less brilliantly. Sarah Palin did it through her hapless coinage of the verb refudiate. I think that the phrase squeezed middle...
She didn't know what she was doing.
I think the phrase squeezed middle is unlikely to persist. The great problem with it, as you can infer from the clip you just played, is that it doesn't actually exclude very many people. It's not clear what the content of it is, indeed.
What was last year's word, Susie? Can you? Sorry, I don't have it to hand.
Don't worry. Well, in the US, they chose app, which is perhaps unsurprising. Mm. And here we chose another two-word. It was big society.
Oh, well, you see, now, big society is... Well, it gives rise to more interesting thoughts, doesn't it, than the squeezed middle, somehow?
Possibly. I think from a linguistic point of view, you can track the success of a word by the number of spin-offs or the way in which it's played upon.
Ah,
and
well,
certainly, squeezed middle, we've had the hourglass economy, we do, you know, the squeezed middle and then the burgeoning sort of mass at the bottom, if you like. People are talking about squeezed bottoms, etc. So there's been lots of wordplay around it.
Sorry. Oliver, do you think we'll be talking about squeezed middle in 5 years?
No, I don't. There are some politicians who have a facility with language. Dennis Healey, Roy Jenkins, Alan Clark. Some speechwriters do. William Safire, who coined the nattering nabobs of negativism.
No, this is
eminently forgettable.
Do you think it'll be around next year, Susie?
Well, potentially. I mean, I should say that the word of the year that we choose is one that's attracted interest in a year. We're not saying
they can
at
be
all.
Ephemeral, in other words.
They certainly can, and we're not saying at all that it'll go into the dictionary. But I think as a capture of the prevailing mood, it works.
Yeah. So just to be clear, it's not going to turn up in any version, apart from anything else. It's not a word, but I mean, it's not going to turn up in the Oxford English Dictionary.
No, not yet. It'll have to show a little bit more longevity before.
Yes. Well, and you don't think it's got legs, do you, Oliver?
I think it's insufficiently precise. It's too vague. It won't last.
There you are. Last word to Oliver Cam. I think I'm with him. It seems a bit of an uninspired choice. And it really only captures the moment in Britain, not in the US, where it's not being used that much, and in any case, it's been around for a long time. Here are some of the runners-up, terms that made it onto the shortlist, but no further. Arab Spring. Occupy. Hacktivism. Very political, these terms. Fracking. And that old favourite, Tiger Mother. Rawr. Thanks for reviving that one, Amy Chua. Okay, now Kate Bush is offering up some words of her own. She has a new album out. It's called 50 Words for Snow. Now, there are certain linguists who, when they hear that title, 50 Words for Snow, they'll start to overheat. Steam will start coming out of their ears. Because it's one of those urban myth expressions. There is no language, including all the Eskimo family of languages, that have 50 or 20 or 23 or whatever it is, words for snow. But everyone can relax, because Kate Bush knows this. The title track has a second vocal part with words spoken by actor and, what do I call him, language aficionado, Stephen Fry, who lists a bunch of words.
Santan Yaruftiko. Stella Tundra.
12.
Hunter's Dream.
13.
Falupan Jumpala.
14.
Zebra Niven.
15.
Spangla Dasha.
The Big Show's Marco Werman Skyped Kate Bush to ask her just what she was thinking about with these 50 words for snow.
So, Kate Bush, I just looked in the thesaurus under snow and I didn't find a Spangla Dasha or Falup Njumpala. I mean, the song almost feels like a nonsensical exercise. How did you and Stephen Fry come together and start riffing on these made-up words for snow?
Well, I had the idea for this song because it's a well-known phrase that Eskimos have 50 words for snow, but actually it's a complete myth. They don't really. And so I started thinking about the idea of, well, you know, do we have 50 words for snow in the English language? And we have a few, like drifting, falling, settling. And so I thought, well, what if, you know, we kind of start this track that would kind of have a groove, and we'd start with words that already exist, and then gradually they would become sillier and sillier and more fantastical. And so I set about kind of making up words that, to me, had a sense of meaning something that was evocative of snow.
Ankle breaker. Erazo dust. Schnamister Flocken. Terra Blizzard. Qualissimo. Vanilla Swarm.
And Stephen Fry is extremely well known in England. He's a very talented man. He's an actor, a broadcaster, and an extremely intelligent man. Mm. And, you know, it's, if he says anything in this country, everybody immediately presumes it's extremely important. So I thought he was the man for the job. So he came in and just spoke the words so beautifully. He has an incredibly beautiful voice.
Mm, he does.
He has narrated talking books like Harry Potter. And so, I mean, I'm knocked out with his performance.
So it kind of has this almost Lewis Carroll kind of quality to it. But I'm just wondering what you were thinking about that idea of myth, you know, the myth here being that, you know, there are 50 Eskimo words for snow.
Yes, yes. I mean, it's a very interesting phrase, isn't it? To think that there would be as many as 50 words about anything is quite a concept.
How'd that myth get started, do you know?
No, I think the Eskimos use phrases for snow. So, you know, they might say icy snow drifting on a river, or falling snow hitting a husky's nose. Or, I mean, I don't know, because I don't really know what the words are.
You collect literary allusions and references to kind of esoteric stuff in your work. There's your first big song, Wuthering Heights. We know you're a fan of James Joyce. You play around with a word like babushka and the mathematical ratio of pi. What does it take when you hear or read something for you to go, there's something there that could become a song?
I think the writing process is very elusive. It's hard to really say why something sort of makes itself known to you in a way that you feel it can become a song. And what I love about being able to work making albums, which of course is really what I do, I can work with music, but I can also work with words. And I love words. I think, you know, they're fascinating. And just by placing words in a slightly different order or with an inflection, it changes it. And what's so interesting about lyrics is that because the words are sung, they can change so dramatically from how they sound when they're spoken. It's almost like a slightly different language.
Mm. Back briefly to the craft of writing songs, Kate Bush. You've written songs on topics that most musicians would stay away from. Nuclear fallout, homosexuality, you've got that song Heads We're Dancing about Hitler. Have you ever happened upon an idea for a song and said, no, that topic is off limits?
Not yet.
Kate Bush speaking with The Big Show's Marco Werman. Big thanks to April Peavy for making that happen. And that's it for this pod. See you next week, or in the meantime, at the World in Words Facebook page or on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Patrick Cox, Patricox. See ya.